Bristol. It's Friday afternoon and welcome to the BCFM Emergency Schedule Dialect Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Online only, along with several other shows on BCFM, because the managing editor, Pat Hartz, told us he doesn't want potential extra work dealing with Ofcom complaints during the pandemic, which is understandable considering what a controversial programme this can be. And as guests, we have four candidates for Bristol Mayor here today in the election that never was. Remember them? No, not the candidates, but the elections, which were due to take place next Thursday, the 7th of May. They are what we used to have when Bristol was a democracy. Remember, we used to get to decide who spends 350 million or so of our money every year. Now, well, we used to get to decide it every 4 years, but that's now been extended. COVID-19 and the Tory government has decided next week's results for us. The previously elected mayor, Marvin Rees, can carry on without being re-elected. The idea of elected mayors was first decided back in 2012. And critics raised the spectre of Bristol becoming a dictatorship, with even the National Union of Journalists branch chair, Christina Zaba, proclaiming in the Bristol Post what a good idea it was. And again, last year, with changes to the city's constitution, reducing the role of elected councillors again, the so-called power grab. The word dictatorship was used again to describe the kind of power the mayor has. And then, this week, we see research from Bristol University and UWE showing that since the mayoral system arrived, trust in the council decisions has fallen from around 20% in 2012, now down to 15%. So this edition of the online-only BCFM politics show is entitled Whatever Happened to Bristol Democracy? Because the 12.5% pay rise the mayor has just awarded himself contrasts with an equivalent pay cut people like the New Zealand Cabinet and many others have taken in recognition of the hardship the nation is suffering during the pandemic. Anyway, a statement came in from the mayor's office, that's Marvin Rees, the Labour mayor, for me, declining to be involved in today's programme, from Simon Cowley. He said, "Dear Tony, I'm sorry, but the mayor is unavailable at that time. He's already regularly speaking about COVID-19 on BCFM, and so additional interview requests will not be prioritised." That's kind regards from Simon Cowley, Bristol's office policy manager. So, no Marvin Rees, which is a great pity, because he's the person we really want to ask many of these questions and hear the answers from him from. In the second hour, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers will be joining us to review Michael Moore's new film, Planet of the Humans. And we examined almost unbelievable prosecution of now former Ambassador Craig Murray, an outspoken supporter of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. Germany's banning of Hezbollah we'll be looking at, and also the World Economic Forum's call to move the global economy onto a Bitcoin-like blockchain system, a new financial architecture for the world. An emergency response exercise also in Sweden emerges that took place 4 days before the Skripal incident 2 years ago. Many of the people involved in that exercise were involved in the real event down in Salisbury 4 days later. Also, Trump wants to blame China for the virus. Will it wash? And finally, the rise to power of Churchill's colleague, we couldn't really call him friends, but someone that Churchill was dealing with at the end of the war, the Nazi Party's Reichsleiter and Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann. And you can compare photographs taken of him in 1944 and 1972. Is it really him in Buenos Aires? So we start now with the cancellation of the elections and then go on to look at the role of the mayor. Has Bristol actually become a dictatorship in the coming year? Are decisions on what to do with our money now much, or are decisions on what to do with our money much quicker, smoother and more businesslike? To discuss that and the pandemic and other issues, I'm joined by four of the five candidates for Bristol Mayor in next week's cancelled elections. Well, they're not really candidates anymore, although I think they still will be running next year. That's from the Liberal Democrats, Mary Page, from the Conservative Party, Samuel Williams, the Green Party, Sandy Hoare-Ruthven, and Trade Union and Socialist Alliance, Tom Baldwin. So I think we'll start with you, Mary, since your faces are up on our screens. I'm not quite sure how you managed to do that. But anyway, first of all, about the cancellation of the elections, I understand that actually some parties are actually supporting this, think it's a good idea.
Obviously, it was the right thing to do. to cancel the elections or postpone the elections, because the public safety is paramount. But for myself and perhaps one of the other candidates, it is a shock and it is a big challenge, because I'm now having to sign on for universal credit because I'd taken a career break in order to run for the post. So it's a new experience, but it's one that I'm sharing with hundreds of thousands of other people across the UK.
In Paris, a couple of weeks ago, they held local elections. Why can't we?
The UK system just isn't set up to be able to do that, as far as I understand it. There are always concerns over online voting fraud.
And for the Green Party, Sandy, what's your thoughts about the postponement for a year of the elections in the city?
Yeah, I agree with Mary that fundamentally it was the right thing to do. The elections rely on people getting out and about, meeting people, knocking on doors, visiting community centres, businesses and that kind of thing. And that's just something we couldn't do. And actually, it's unfair if people aren't allowed to get out and get their message across. So I agree with the postponement of the election. What it has allowed me to do is to get back into my day job and start to work with young people, making sure that they're safe, that they're getting the services they need, the support that they need.
Okay, so Tom, what do you make of the cancellation of the elections? Is it inevitable?
I think a postponement was necessary. I think announcing straight off the bat that it was going to be a year's postponement was maybe jumping the gun when we didn't know what position we'd be in 6 months' time. I agree with the points that Sandy made about campaigning as well as the running of the vote itself. And that would have particularly impacted parties like the Socialist Party that don't have the resources that some of the larger parties have. Aren't able to purchase the billboards, the bus ads, that kind of thing. So rely much more on the face-to-face campaigning. But the point that you made about the mayor and councillors' pay increase, I think, you know, in any case, the pay of the mayor puts them well out of the lifestyle of the average Bristolian that they're supposed to be representing. I think that in and of itself creates a democratic deficit. But on top of that, it's especially galling that they voted that through in 37 seconds when they are going without re-election for an entire year. And when a lot of people are facing a 20% pay cut because of the furlough scheme.
Well, OK, so you're talking about 20%. Some people have got 100% pay cut, I'm afraid. And anyway, Sam, what do you make of this decision to do with the postponement of the elections? I understand the government actually recommended that it should, or some, not the government, but civil servants recommended it should be 6 months. But then it was decided a year would be better, which could potentially put us back into the next flu season. That doesn't necessarily... there are got to be a few questions about whether that's a good idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I echo much of what the others, Tom, Sandy and Mary, have said, really. Of course, I do think it was the right decision, but it puts us in a really very difficult position going forward. As you mentioned, we don't know, actually, if we're honest with ourselves. We have good science and good advisors on it, but we don't know when a second peak, if a second peak, will come, and what that will look like. So setting a time for the election, as Tom mentioned, maybe saying it'll be a year was jumping the gun a bit. And we've got to ask, what difficult position does that leave us in when next year, if it's to be next May, it puts us into a position of having councillor elections, the mayoral election, of course, police and crime commissioner, and of course the Weka mayor role as well was due to be held then. So actually it puts us into a very difficult position. Whether it will be next May or not, that's yet to be seen. But I echo what has been said. It's got to be the right decision. We've got to put the welfare of people, of our communities first. And so it was the right thing to postpone, difficult position now.
And the other question, of course, is maybe those elections might look a bit different. It might not be ballot boxes. It might not be bits of paper. It might be electronic voting of some sort. And that is also, that's a whole can of worms comes with that as well, because it's been shown time and time again that some of these systems used for electronic voting can actually be hacked. And you can literally pick up a whole, like, thousands of votes and drop them on your computer screen into a different candidate's. So what I'm saying is the paper trail is not there in these electronic voting. Anyway, let's talk now about the role of mayor. And I come to you first again, Mary, because I know you're standing on the platform of actually abolishing the role of mayor. How would you intend to do that if you had won next week?
From the very first, from the outset, the Liberal Democrat group has made a commitment to go through with delegating power throughout the council to the councillors. And we believe that's the fundamental offset of all of that centralised power and control of the mayor that they have at the moment. I mean, obviously, if it's held at the same time as the Wecker mayoral, that is going to absolutely highlight the point for me about the ridiculousness that we have both a city mayor and a regional mayor. And that dilutes our ability to have one clear voice to government to say, this is the importance of the West of England region. This is the importance of Bristol within that setup. And these are the elected officials. These are the councillors who are working as community activists Absolutely, they are doing that now with the COVID-19 response groups and hubs. They are working so hard with local community activists to provide food, to provide support, just to provide talking to individuals who are struggling with what's going on with lockdown and not being able to live life as they used to.
But Mary, I mean, this is what we heard from Marvin Rees when he was elected. He said he wanted to have what he called a rainbow cabinet, bring all the different parties in. What guarantees have we got from you that you wouldn't do the same? That is, after a little while, you would then say, well, actually, all I want is Lib Dems in my cabinet.
He didn't keep his word, did he? So we know already there is only one candidate in the next election where we already know that we can't trust anything they say because they didn't stick to what they said. Myself and the other candidates have still got to prove that we can be trusted. And that is what the electorate is going to have to gamble on or make educated choices on next time round. I stick to my word. I have absolutely no interest in running a campaign to get rid of a position that I fundamentally disagree with it existing. And I'm one of those people who was excited by the idea of a Bristol mayor and who voted to have the Bristol mayor the first time round. But that was because I wanted this voice of a region to government. And the Bristol mayor was the only option I was being given. But then in 2017, we had the elections for the regional mayor and we were given what could be a better option. At the moment, it doesn't function like that. At the moment, it could be doing far more to improve transport infrastructure, to look at pollution across the patch and to look at how we maximise the benefit for citizens here without the risks and issues of people dying from poor air quality across the region. And, you know, looking at the sort of recycling rates that we could do across the region, everything that we could do, the transport, improving the transport systems, if we were looking at the million or so people in that travel to work region, rather than just looking after something within our borders.
Can we go now to Tom? Tom, can you just give us your thoughts on this whole idea of how well the idea of an elected mayor has worked? And what you make of, what would you be doing if you became mayor? Would you carry on with this post and take the powers that were given to George Ferguson and Marvin Rees and be almost like a kind of chief executive of the city or not?
Well, I voted against the mayoral system. I do think it's less democratic. It allows a budget to be passed with the support of only one third of the councillors in certain circumstances. I think, however, probably more important than the nature of the system you've got is, you know, what the political agenda of the person that holds that office is. And unfortunately, with the last two mayors, we have seen cuts voted through, cuts that have been made to the city's income by the Tory government, but have then been passed on rather than resisted by those mayors. And you mentioned that trust in the council has fallen over the time that we've had the mayoral system. I think that's not just the democratic deficit, the fact that councillors, which are a bit closer to the people that elect them, have far less of a voice, but also the fact that, you know, we have seen a butchering really of council services. And the main thrust of the policies on which I'm standing is to oppose that austerity and to really launch and lead a campaign to protect local services. I think I'd also say, you know, you mentioned that the vote could look very different come next May. I think that will be not necessarily just in terms of how the vote is conducted, but particularly in terms of what the political landscape will look like, because I think that this coronavirus crisis has revealed a great deal about the society we lived in, laid bare some of the inequities and the failings of capitalism and of the Tory government. I think, you know, revealed really an agenda that puts maintaining profits ahead of protecting people's health. I think we were way too slow to go into the lockdown. I know this encroaches on questions we'll deal with later, but I think it's also revealed a failure of austerity, the cuts to our health service, to our care services and others, and really also the inability of the free market to deliver. That even the Tory government have had to nationalise the railways, for example. They've had to pump in huge state spending in order to try and mitigate the effects of this crisis. And there's even been elements of state direction of industry trying to encourage the production of necessary PPE, medical equipment and other things. So I think...
Okay, but I mean, I'm really trying to focus here, Tom, on the whole idea of mayor, the mayor. And I'd just like to hear you, if you could just summarise why you think the mayor is a good or bad idea, just in a few words.
I think it's a bad idea. I think it centralises the power of the city in the hands of a single person. I think it reduces the voice that councillors have and therefore the voice that people have when they vote for them. But as I say, the political agenda of the council and the mayor is probably more important than the means by which it's organised.
Really, I think Tom was pretty much finished answering that. So... can I ask you, Sandy, since you've popped up there and you're ready, the whole idea of the role of mayor, what do you make of this? Is it a good idea or a bad idea? And what have we learned over the last, well, it's 8 years now since we decided to have an elected mayor, isn't it?
Yeah, it is about 8 years since we chose to have an elected mayor. I mean, I think the key thing is that people voted for it because they wanted to see action. They wanted to see things change. So I think people's frustration with the position is more about the frustration that actually very little is happening. And, you know, in response to Mary's point, the idea of kind of scrapping the mayor, well, we have the chance to do that in 2022. There will be a referendum in 2022 where people can decide whether they want to keep the mayoral system or not. So in the meantime, I think we should be able to...
Are you committing to that then?
Be a referendum. Well, there will be, so people can put together
only if one of us chooses to do so.
If there is a petition with 28,000 people or whatever it needs, then absolutely we will commit to having a referendum. If people don't want a referendum, then we won't have one. That's up to the people. And in the meantime, I think we need to get on with things. And I think there's a good example right now. Cities across the world who are in lockdown are giving space back to cyclists, to pedestrians, by widening pavements, by putting in extra cycle lanes. Those are the sorts of things that we should be doing now that will help us to build for the future. We should be putting in the clean air zone that the mayor had said originally he was committed to rolling out next year, but has now reneged on that. So it's really important that I think people are looking for a mayor to actually take action, actually make a difference to the city. But instead, we've ended up really with nothing better than we had before, and actually I think we more need a change of mayor than a change of system.
Sandy, on the clean air zone, this is not popular in the city, and there's all sorts of questions about who's going to be able to use it and who isn't, and also of course there's another big question, which is, are things actually going to be going back to normal? So the air pollution that was around before the pandemic, is that just going to simply return when it's finished? So surely it's a sensible thing to stop this extra level of taxation and bureaucracy if it doesn't appear like it may even be needed.
I'm really sorry, Tony, but you're coming through very distorted. I sort of heard the beginning of that, but not the end of it, I'm afraid.
Okay, so I'll say that again. I mean, it's really about the clean air zone, which is unpopular generally, and it's another level of taxation. And anyway, it looks to many people as if the air is going to be a lot cleaner after this pandemic anyway.
So I think what you're saying is that the air is cleaner. We're legally clean now. We're breathing clean air and less people are suffering as a result. And that's, to me, why we should actually take this opportunity, capture this moment and put in the clean air zone, because it will keep our air clean. If we end up going back to the way we were before, then we will end up just having to fight the same battle again. You know, the clean air, people talk to me about the clean air zone, and I understand for some people they're nervous about it, what's it going to do to their businesses and that kind of thing. But I also speak to people who suffer from the dirty air that we breathe, who have asthma, who struggle with health difficulties as a result. And so it's important that a mayor or whoever's leading the city can actually make the decision to clean up our air. And not just be bullied by business who say we need it. So now is the time to do that while we have clean air, while people are getting used to having less traffic on our streets. If we put those things in now, then we can keep them. As we slowly reopen the economy over the coming months, people will get used to cycling more, walking more and driving their car less.
Well, some people might say that's cashing in on the pandemic. Anyway, look, Sam, let's hear from you about your thoughts about the role of the mayor, almost the most important person we're hearing from about this, because I know the Conservative Party were big supporters of the idea of a role of mayor originally back in 2012.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a real hard journey, I think, for many Conservatives who were backed and continue to back a mayoral position and the rollout of great devolution to our cities and our towns. And yet, I echo what I've heard from Mary and from Tom as well, that actually the system here in Bristol, with the characters that we've had, have reduced the level of democracy and democratization across the city. And that's a real issue. When our communities are being left behind, when there's swathes of people who are wanting to be represented within this representational democracy we have, but are failing to be done, because of the lack of power, of responsibility, and of voice that their representatives, the councillors, have been given within cabinet due to the pulling back of the Rainbow Cabinet, as we've spoken about, that failure of the current mayor there, but also the lack of engagement that councillors are being given within the decision-making process. And for me, that's such a huge issue when we have a very active community across Bristol, actually. We have a fantastic city where people are wanting to engage, wanting to gills and their energy and resources to the city, are unable to do so because it either does or does not fit the agenda of a single man. Now that's concerning, and I don't feel comfortable placing democracy on that. And so that the reason I say it's a hard thing for many Conservatives is that in theory, there's benefits to the role. Some of those you mentioned right at the beginning. But actually, when it all lands on the goodwill of a single person with minimal checks and balances, with minimal accountability, that's a really concerning place to be. And it's just not working for Bristolians. And so, unlike Sandy, I am committing to calling that referendum, not just simply saying it's up to the people. I don't think that's a strong enough position for the lack of democracy that our city is seeing at the moment. We need to be much stronger in this so that our communities can be given the voice that they are sorely lacking at the moment because of the system.
Okay. Can I just come in on that?
Sam, I mean, one important point I'd just like to put to Sam, please. Let me just put this point to Sam, is that the mayor at the moment, I mean, this week is really batting for Bristol because he's been demanding £82 million from central government, as he's done this week, saying this is the actual cost to Bristol. Now, surely this is the sort of thing that we need a decisive individual mayor for, rather than having to go through loads of committees to sign off decisions like making statements like that demand to get enough money to run the city during the pandemic.
Failing to recognise the fact that we've got, as Mary pointed out, both a regional mayor, currently under Tim Bowles, and the city mayor. Bristol has received, I believe it's £26 million to date from the government in response to COVID-19, and over £300 million across the region. Now, that is not simply by the power or the negotiation of Marvin Rees. Actually, that's a significant number of other parties in the running there, including the regional mayor. And I'd argue that the responses like this need to be much more regional than simply citywide. And so a regional mayor suits that position much, much better, much more strongly.
Can I make a point here that actually part of the idea behind a mayor was not only to run the city, but actually to devolve power and money. And therefore, the system won't work until central government actually gives power to local authorities, whether that's run by councillors or a mayor. Currently, the Conservatives have given the democratic power, but no other power. We can't, the city can't raise its own taxes. It can't run its own planning rules and those sorts of things. So ultimately, it's a system that is very difficult and relies heavily on asking or demanding money from central government, as opposed to the city being able to run itself. The whole idea of having a mayor was to be for the city to be able to forge its own future.
Yeah, and so
I have to admit that there is, you know, I've got to admit, I agree with Sandy on that. You know, I do have to agree with Sandy on that government needs to, regardless of the colour of the government, but in particular this Conservative government with the commitment to directly elected regional mayors. And I believe there's a white paper in progress at the moment. So, you know, we really ought to be saying there ought to be more ability and budget to go with that responsibility that has been handed down. And there, you know, we really ought to be able to change our local laws here in order to sort the needs of Bristolians. And absolutely, I back 100% the council's commitment to having citizens' assemblies. And would go further than that, because again, I think I'm the only candidate who is offering the scrap the mayor policy and to delegate power not only to councillors but to communities, because I think getting rid of the neighbourhood partnerships was a mistake. And that's this is a point about the mayor, Tony. The fact is that one fallible human being is in charge. And we've seen what a disaster that has been for the country with Boris Johnson, and the fact that our deaths in the UK have surpassed the number of deaths in any other European country.
Okay, let me just so this
whereby South Africa's
death rate, what you're doing here is very helpfully bringing us in to talk about the pandemic. Let me just also point out that the British, the numbers of deaths per million in Britain are way below actually that of Spain and Italy. So you have to look at these, not just the numbers of deaths, but the number of deaths per number of population. But let's have a listen now to Boris Johnson earlier this week.
We do indeed. But if you look at how other countries, it's really hard to hear you, Tony, actually. You might need to check your headphone connection, because it's you've put your headset on, that's since we got the distortions. But looking at the news this morning, as they're saying, about South Africa and how they dealt with it differently and how they went into lockdown sooner, and their trajectory of death rate has been significantly lower in a country where one might have expected to have other factors due to deprivation, levels of deprivation, causing more deaths. And if you again look around at the other countries that have dealt with this better, there's one thing in common, and all of the countries that have got a lower death rate apart from South Africa have got female leaders.
What I'd like to do is to talk about the pandemic in a minute after we've heard from Boris Johnson in his announcement earlier this week. If we could hear that clip now, please.
I know there will be many people looking now at our apparent success and beginning to wonder whether now is the time to go easy on those social distancing measures. And I know how hard and how stressful it has been to give up, even temporarily, those ancient and basic freedoms, not seeing friends, not seeing loved ones, working from home, managing the kids, worrying about your job and your firm. So let me say directly also to British business, to the shopkeepers, to the entrepreneurs, to the hospitality sector, to everyone on whom our economy depends. I understand your impatience. I share your anxiety. And I know that without our private sector, without the drive and commitment of the wealth creators of this country, there will be no economy to speak of. There will be no cash to pay for our public services, no way of funding our NHS. And yes, I can see the long-term consequences of lockdown as clearly as anyone. And so, yes, I entirely share your urgency. It's the government's urgency. And yet we must also recognise the risk of a second spike, the risk of losing control of that virus and letting the reproduction rate go back over one. Because that would mean not only a new wave of death and disease, but also an economic disaster. And we would be forced once again to slam on the brakes across the whole country and the whole economy, and reimpose restrictions in such a way as to do more and lasting damage. And so I know it is tough, and I want to get this economy moving as fast as I can, but I refuse to throw away all the effort and the sacrifice of the British people, and to risk a second major outbreak and huge loss of life and the overwhelming of the NHS. And I ask you to contain your impatience, because I believe we are coming now to the end of the first phase of this conflict. And in spite of all the suffering, we have so nearly succeeded.
So that's Boris Johnson speaking on his return after having the illness himself to Downing Street earlier this week. Can we start with you this time, Tom? Can you just give us your thoughts on what this idea? I mean, because we were told, weren't we, this was going to be a 3-week lockdown. We're now being told actually it's being extended indefinitely.
I'm just on that statement that he's made, the description that the government's intervention has been a success. I'm not sure on what planet you could describe the level of deaths that the UK has seen as a success, unless you were deliberately trying to cause that number of deaths. I think, you know, on the claim that the economy depends on wealth creators like entrepreneurs and small businesses, I think what this crisis has proved, the list of key workers doesn't include entrepreneurs. The people that create the wealth and the people that keep this society running are workers. And we've had a shoddy deal years and years. I think, you know, as I say, we'll see a different political balance after this crisis. And one of the results, I hope, will be a greater confidence of workers to push not just for the protection that they need, which is the big fight at the moment, but actually, you know, for the respect and the income that they deserve as well. On the question of the lockdown, it has been very difficult, and I think everybody recognises this, but I'm with the majority of people, as surveys have revealed, who want it to remain as long as it is necessary for it to remain. I think, you know, the government have been driven really from the start by a desire to and pressure from big business to reopen so that they can continue making profits rather than protecting people's health. If you remember, Boris Johnson's instinct on this was take it on the chin. And I think consistently their response has been behind the curve.
Okay, Tom. Can we get your response, Sam Williams, from the Conservative Party to Boris's statement that this is going to have to carry on?
Yeah, absolutely. I share some of what we've just heard there from Tom, that actually I think most people, 60-some percent of people are concerned about lockdown restrictions being lifted too soon and going out. I disagree, however, with what we've just heard about the sort of the behind the scenes negotiations just to get business going again. I absolutely am confident that our government has had the best will of our country at heart. And let's be honest, this is a novel situation. We've heard a lot. Suddenly everybody has become experts on virology or the like. The reality is this is a new situation, and many of us, including governments around the world, have been responding to the best of their ability. And that ability is not just governments making decisions behind closed doors, but seeking the advice of the experts. And so we need to recognize that, and I think bring some greater level of nuance and pragmatism really back to the conversation to say that our government have actually responded remarkably well, and yet, of course, awful tragedy of losing huge numbers of people. And so something has not been right. I admit that, absolutely. But let's be clear, the government have been working wholeheartedly to deliver the best.
Okay. Before we hear from Sandy and Mary on this, we're going to hear from the Swedish. Over in Sweden, they've decided not to do a lockdown. And one of their advisors, he's actually 80 years old himself, is a guy called Johan Giesecke, who's an epidemiologist who's written some of the global textbooks on epidemiology. And we're going to hear three clips from him now. First of all, one about why he believes that Sweden, by not having a lockdown for its younger people, is not going to have a second wave of the virus.
This infection will mostly spread from people who are asymptomatic to other people who are asymptomatic. So most of the spread of the virus you don't even see. It's from people who think they're healthy to other people who will also feel healthy. The severe cases are a minority of all the disease spread.
And that 2.5% that you believe are infected now,
That we know, not believe. We know that 2.5% are infected.
How do you know?
Or they're sick right now, because they've been tested with PCR tests. Out of a big sample of Swedish people, 2.5% were PCR positive, which means that they have the infection right now.
But for you to achieve herd immunity, surely you need over 50%. You need a far bigger proportion of your population to.
But we can't mix two things here. One is if you have the infection right now, and one is if you had it. There are two different tests, and you and I are not talking about the same thing now. I will say 2.5% have the infection right now, and we believe they will be immune afterwards. At the same time, we're testing large groups for antibody, and we're finding that at present, 30% of the Stockholm population is immune or has had the infection. We had the maximum peak in spread last week, probably. And to go from 30 to 50% will go quickly. That will only take weeks.
Okay, so that's the guy's name is Johan Giesecke. He's author of books on epidemiology that have been used around the world. Mary, it's really their idea there basically is allow your young people to catch this, isolate people who are more vulnerable, and you don't have to then worry about having this second wave. This is the second wave we're now concerned about here in Britain. They're not so concerned about it in Sweden.
Yeah, my background is having grown up with a father who worked with Rosalind Franklin, who contributed to the discovery of DNA with her X-ray crystallography. And so I've been brought up in a science tradition. I've been working in manufacturing for 6.5 years with some of the country's most amazing manufacturers, and some of whom have really stepped up to provide new breathing equipment and for intensive care situations, and some have done the CPAP, some have done ventilators, and so there's. What that's taught me is there's quite often a number of ways and a number of experts, and you know, at the moment, I wouldn't trust an expert who says this is the absolute truth. I will trust the experts who say, to the best of our knowledge, this is what we think, because that's what we're finding. There are a variety of tests. There are a variety of, you know, and in the UK, they've admitted that we haven't got antibody tests yet. We only have antigen tests. And we are not doing that level of testing in the UK. My friend recently...
Well, you're talking about... Hang on a second, please. Mary, we're talking here about the idea of possible reinfection with COVID-19. Now, in Sweden, what he's saying and what the Swedish epidemiologists are saying is they don't have any evidence of actual reinfection. What there is some evidence of is that you can be tested twice for the COVID-19, and the tests will come out differently if you've got different levels of it. But they're saying there's been no substantial reinfection at all in Sweden.
They have a tiny population compared to the UK. And I think that they also have a country situation that is different to the UK. We cannot look at the exact detail of how another country has dealt with this and then apply it absolutely to here. We have got to look at our own situation, look at the behaviours and patterns of the UK population, and protect them. And yes, you know, I'd have to agree to a certain extent with Samuel that I'm sure that this government thought that they had the best interests of the public at heart. It would be abhorrent to think that they actually intended to kill so many people in the UK. That would make them monsters. But, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and their reaction was slow. Sandy said that they were behind the curve. They were. Had they closed the borders, had they put tests in at the airports when actually people were flying in from high infection rate areas around the world, we wouldn't have had so many cases in so many places all over the UK. And at the moment, we are just playing catch up. And there are so many people across the country who are terrified for the people that they care about, who are vulnerable, who are at risk.
Okay, Mary. Can we now hear from Sandy what you make of Boris's decision to extend this lockdown indefinitely?
Well, the first thing I'm going to say is I'm not an expert. I think there's a lot of pundits talking about a lot of figures and who's got a higher death rate or a lower death rate. I think having managed through crises myself, I've run an organisation for a long time, it is almost impossible to second guess really what's going on. And so I think we need to be really careful.
Sandy, sorry, but one of the key things here is testing, isn't it? And we haven't testing.
Just let me finish, Tony. Yeah. However, We should have what seems to be clear from my layperson's point of view is that we should have locked down sooner and should have invested in PPE and ventilators and things like that sooner than we did. I think I can't remember who said it, but Boris's instinct is to sort of let it run, take it on the chin. I think that was the wrong instinct, and actually we should have locked down sooner. And I think that has cost lives is actually making the whole situation more painful. I think we're learning to trust our experts again. I think that's a good thing. I think we need to listen harder to the scientists and understand what it is that they're saying. And what I would also say, to bring it back to Bristol, the country and to Bristol, is that now I want to start seeing how we're going to get out of this. So not just the lockdown. I think it's the right thing to extend the lockdown as it is. But the economy has broadly been nationalised, and therefore we've got an opportunity here to grow in a different way, to create really good jobs for local people. So one of the responses has to be that our supply chains that stretch across the world could be more localised. That's good for the environment, it's good for local jobs, and it's good for local business. We should be investing, as I've said before, in better transport, more active travel and sustainable travel. So I want to see that vision for a new economy that is not only going to tackle the economic problems we have, but really invest again in our communities, really invest in local jobs and green growth. And, we're gaining some things out of this crisis. And I think we need to capture that sense of community that we've got and be able to bring jobs back home again.
OK, Samuel Williams for the Conservatives. Boris is basically going to extend this indefinitely. And we're hearing as we just heard from Sweden, maybe we can hear another quick clip from Sweden, please, about what's going on over there. Because not only are they saying they've got no evidence of reinfection, they don't think they're going to have to deal with any kind of second wave. Now, most of the population, I think they're now up to nearly 50% of the population have had this disease and recovered. And they are pointing out why testing is so crucial. So let's hear a little bit more from Johan Giesecke, who's the advisor to the Swedish government.
This is a disease that's very contagious, far more contagious than we first believed. And it's spreading. There's no way to stop it. It's spreading. It will reach every corner of your country and Sweden as well in the end. Unless the vaccine comes first, but that's doubtful.
So if you're suggesting that the curves will even out, the mortality rates will even out, explain to me, and sorry that you're having to repeat yourself, but explain to me so that I can understand it, why they would even out. Because obviously at the moment you have more deaths per head of population than we have here in Northern Ireland, where we have a more intensive lockdown. So why do you think that will eventually even out?
Because you have to lift the lockdown at some point. And at that point, there will be deaths in Ireland or in the UK.
Sorry, I don't understand. Tell me that again.
Well, when you ease the lockup and the virus starts spreading again, which it will, then you'll have more deaths.
But why will you at the same time not have more deaths when there's a second wave for your country?
There's not a second wave. I'm not talking about the second wave. I'm talking about the first wave. And because we'll have herd immunity by the time other countries start opening or start lifting their lockdown, which means that the virus won't spread very much more in Sweden, whereas you'll have this problem when you lift the lockdown that you have higher number of cases and deaths in that.
Righto, so Sam, we're just hearing from Sweden that they are confident that when the lockdown is lifted in Sweden, that the disease will not be being passed around because they've allowed so many people to catch it. That's their assessment, and obviously we won't know, but it looks as if it's feasible that Britain has actually gone down a way where we've locked ourselves into almost permanent lockdown.
Thank you, Tony. I certainly hope that is not the case, and I'm confident that those advising the government at this stage also do not believe that's the case. But certainly you will have read, as I have read, different studies that have been coming out around how we now ease this lockdown. We heard in the clip there the two dilemmas that you're left with, really. The way that Sweden have gone with no lockdown, almost no lockdown, just isolating those at greatest need, so that then a herd is achieved amongst those who the virus has less likelihood of having severe impact upon, so it has less impact. We've gone for a position of isolating everyone so that there's less transmission of the virus. Now, both have probably pros and cons. I'm not an expert, certainly, but we do need to now, the government now needs to start thinking about how we ease this lockdown in a way that ensures that we can start transmitting to those who it won't have such significant impact upon, namely, we believe the maybe the younger members of our society who it won't have such severe impact on, but will start to build that herd immunity. Now, we'll start to see what that process will look like over the weeks ahead. Hopefully it won't be months and months. But as I mentioned earlier, this is a novel situation. And so we're journeying with it, with the experts, with the advice, and I'm confident that we will hear more and more over the weeks ahead, as we've been hearing each day from the government briefings.
Finally, Sam, I know you've got to go, but finally, could you just use your crystal ball? Are we going to ever get back to normal?
There's going to be a new normal. I think it's fair to say it's going to be a new normal. The economy won't look the same again. Signs are looking significant. Greater level of financial from the financial crash in 08. There will be significant impacts on people's lives, on the community, and of course. No more greater, actually, than those thousands of families who have lost loved ones. And so we must continue to think about them, but can also continue to think about how we operate in this new normal. There are great opportunities that come from the fact that our air is cleaner, that we can look at transport again and take the opportunity. Like I'm seeing across Europe at the moment, we've seen France, for instance, come out with a 50 euro grant for everyone for bike maintenance. So it encourages people to get on their bicycles and adopt to this new normal. So there's opportunities, but we mustn't forget about the tragedy of those who have lost loved ones and indeed those who have lost their lives.
Okay, Sam, thanks very much. I know you've got to go now, but we'll be carrying on with the others who are. Of course.
Great, Tony. Thank you so much for having me.
So that's from the Liberal Democrats, Mary Page. The Conservative Party is just having to go now, Sam Williams. The Green Party's Sandy Hoare Ruthven and Trade Union and Socialist Alliance, Tom Baldwin. The Labour candidate in these postponed elections is Marvin Rees, who could not join us today. I got an apology from his office, but thanks very much for joining us, Sam.
Thank you so much.
One of the major problems with the pandemic, and I don't think anyone would dispute this at all, has been the lack of testing. So we don't actually know where the disease is. In fact, we interviewed a woman from Shirehampton with her two children a couple of weeks ago who was trying to get tested and couldn't get tested at all, even though she'd had she believed she'd had the COVID-19 with her two small children for around about 4 weeks. So let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions this week, where Keir Starmer put this point to Dominic Raab, who was standing in for Boris Johnson.
From yesterday's data, it appears that that just isn't the case in care homes. They show that deaths in care homes appear to have been rising, even while hospital deaths have been falling. And that's on the back, as the First Secretary knows, of concern for some weeks from the front line about testing in care homes and the speed of testing, about concerns about protective equipment and arguments that it's been too slow. We've all heard from the front line in the care sector expressions of real anxiety about the situation that they find themselves in. So can the First Secretary explain why he thinks that coronavirus continues to spread so fast in the care sector? And returning briefly to something from last week, but I think the First Secretary has already touched on it, could he give us the up-to-date figures for the number of those that have died on the front line in the healthcare staff and the number of social care workers? I raised it last week. I think he's given a figure, but just to confirm that.
First Secretary.
Well, can I thank the right honourable gentleman? I have already given those figures, and they are, of course, produced in the normal way, and he will be appraised of them just as he is in relation to the other figures. It's absolutely right to say that there is a challenge in care homes. In fact, when Sage produced their advice and when the Chief Scientific Advisor and the Chief Medical Officer gave their three-weekly review several weeks ago now, it was made clear that we had made good progress overall in reducing the level of community transmission, but there were still challenges both in hospital settings but also specifically in care homes. There are real challenges in care homes. The principal challenge in care homes, unlike in the NHS setting where we've made such good progress, is the greater challenge from a decentralised basis in terms of having exercising control over the ebb and flow of people into those care homes. That includes residents, it includes care home workers, which sometimes work in different care homes. It also includes NHS workers and, of course, friends and family. That is the single biggest challenge in terms of reducing transmission. But I hope I can reassure him that we have a comprehensive plan to ramp up the testing in care homes. The eligibility was changed yesterday by the Health Secretary to overhaul the way PPE is delivered to those in the front line. And we're also expanding the workforce by 20,000 through a new recruitment campaign. But there is no doubting, Mr. Speaker, and I will not shy away from saying in front of the right honourable gentleman that this is a challenge, but it is a challenge that we must grip and that we can grip to make sure that those in care, we can get the numbers down in care homes, as we've seen in hospitals and as we've seen in the country at large.
Keir Starmer.
So that's the standing in there for Boris Johnson at Prime Minister's Questions this week is Dominic Raab. Really, Mary, talking about testing, two things really, testing and care homes, both combined. All sorts of problems here because we have actually had patients being taken back to care homes from hospital and then transmitting COVID-19 to those care homes in certain parts of the world. Very difficult to know, of course, what's going on if people are not being tested. This week, they've really just started a testing program in care homes. Also, though, of course, once the testing starts, then, of course, the number of cases of people who have COVID-19 is bound to start going up.
I think the situation with the nation's care homes and vulnerable and elderly residents is probably one of the most traumatic that anyone is dealing with. Because of lockdown, we are unable to go and visit those we care about and who need us to care about so much. I'm dealing with that situation myself. I have a nearly 90-year-old father with Alzheimer's and dementia in a care home in the Midlands, and I am wholly reliant on the wonderful staff there to make sure that he is okay, that he is fed in the normal way, that he's looked after, that he's entertained. And the thought that a patient with COVID could return to the home or leave the home and come in and out of the home and bring that risk into the home, or a staff member could, you know, it is terrifying when you can do nothing about it. I just have to trust that that will happen. And that's why...
Now, sorry to interrupt you, Mary. Mary, sorry to interrupt you. Mary, sorry to interrupt you in mid-flow there, but, I mean, this is a serious, serious problem, isn't it? Because many people may be thinking, well, I don't want to hand my loved one over to the hospitals or the NHS or the care services if I'm never going to see them again. There's a tremendous amount of fear around catching COVID-19 as well, in potentially in hospitals. We've seen A&E departments which were previously bursting almost empty.
Yeah, absolutely. The situation with people with non-COVID related diseases or illnesses or conditions, being too scared to go and access healthcare, is a ticking time bomb for perhaps future deaths, unexpected deaths, where we would normally be able to treat those conditions. It is fantastic and phenomenal what they've done with putting together the Nightingale hospitals. In Bristol, or just outside Bristol at UWE facilities, we have, I think, the largest in the country. And the care that people will get there will be excellent, I'm sure. But, you know, the fact that other people are too scared to go and access hospital facilities, there, you know, surely there is a way to perhaps utilise those facilities to only treat majority of COVID patients, so you could then reduce the risk of cross-contamination within the hospital and make other areas safe, so that people with non-COVID related symptoms be safer to access the services they need. Again, you know, I've had to face that choice myself. I had to go for an urgent 2-week referral to St Michael's Hospital recently, and that will be the same decisions that other people are facing right now. They choose between, do I gamble and risk that the condition I have, and thankfully everything is okay for me, although I find out the final tests in 4 weeks' time. But, you know, you have to balance the risk of your own healthcare or your loved ones. And when it is a parent deciding for their children, or my age group deciding for their elderly parents, you know, we are in an invidious position. And that is why it's so important to bring forward a better testing regime than we've currently had. Although certainly friends who have used the Bristol facilities, the Bristol Airport testing, have only got praise for the staff who are running that service.
Tom, it's taken roughly 2 months since this became obvious that it was a serious disease to deal with for this testing to start to be ramped up. I mean, this is just for emergency workers, essential workers, and in care homes. Isn't it almost inevitable? We're now going to start to see a rise in cases because many of those asymptomatic people are going to be now being tested and testing positive. And also, I wonder if you could also address this whole issue of the number of deaths in care homes.
Well, if I start with the testing, I think that the lack of testing has been just one facet of the government's repeated failures to deal with this crisis effectively. The lack of testing means that we've missed any possible window to track and to contain the disease. And, you know, the target that they're talking about of 100,000 tests a day, a target which they still haven't hit yet, that represents less than 1% of the country's population every week. That is not effective in terms of tracking the number of cases, as your Swedish epidemiologist mentioned, of, you know, the transmission from asymptomatic to asymptomatic hosts of the disease, for example. You know, as I say, it's just one facet, really, of the government's failure. I think, you know, inevitably, once we know what the true figures are through more testing, the number of cases that are recorded will rise. That's not something I'm bothered about, in the sense that it doesn't actually mean the number of cases will rise. It just means the official figures will rise. And I think it's far more important to know what the true situation is and to address that than it is to stumble around in the dark, as in reality that the government's response has been. In the case of the care homes, we heard in the response that Dominic Raab, standing in for Boris Johnson, gave, that one of the big challenges with care homes is they're decentralised. And, you know, in reality, what that means is the majority of care providers are privately owned. And that means that it's not just a lack of overall control and oversight that is an issue, but also that these care providers exist primarily to make a profit. That comes first. That comes before concern for the staff and even concern for the service users. And that, you know, is part of the reason, I think, why there hasn't been sufficient protective equipment and stuff in the care homes. But actually, we've seen even within the NHS, that protective equipment and testing has been sorely lacking. And, you know, unfortunately, as of today, the 1st of May, that's still the case.
I think I want to go back to, you know, a point. I want to go back to a point I made earlier about some of the better results across the globe are from countries where they have got a female leader. And I think that there is an opportunity there. We can't generalize. We are not only our gender. We are a whole human being with experiences and talents and skills and qualifications. But it seems to be that the female leaders across the globe have managed to have a much more empathetic response to tackling this and understanding the practical reality of life for their citizens. And I think that unfortunately we have got a situation in the UK where we have a very privileged class, predominantly white male, many of them millionaires, running the country, and they cannot possibly understand or relate to the lives of people here in Bristol who are scratching about from week to week trying to make ends meet on a universal credit system and a benefit system, or dealing with their relatives in care homes and having to squeeze that in between taking their their kids to the school run if they're a key worker, or having to home tutor while still running a business, as many people are in Bristol. And when you get that disconnect from the people who are textbook politicians, who can quote you the policy verse by verse and say, well, it ought to work like this, and instead of having politicians who have lived real lives and have got experience to understand the challenges that each of us face and has some empathy, then I think that's one of the major problems with the situation we have in the care homes, is not enough of our senior governmental politicians understand what that is like to have a relative in adult social care.
Well, let's finally go to looking at the Mayor Marvin Rees, the Labour Mayor Marvin Rees, who sadly couldn't join us today. His response to some of the emotional issues and the difficulties that people are having around the city for example, not being able to be with loved ones at their deathbed. And this is a horrendous thing, not being able to go to funerals and that kind of thing. So on the BCFM One Love Breakfast earlier this week, this is what the Labour Mayor Marvin Rees had to say about that.
We recognise that people are going to lose people at this time,
yeah.
Go home to empty homes and not be able to mourn them properly. But mourning doesn't stop within, obviously, you know, a few weeks of someone's passing, it goes on. So that's what it's for. So we are urging people still if it's for the purposes of exercise, please go to the parks,
yeah.
And protect the space within the cemeteries for those who are going there to mourn, because that's what this is about. But this is based on you know, collective goodwill, really, and the common good. So we just need people to try and protect that space. But it's from Thursday,
yeah.
4 to 8 on a weekday and 10 to 6 on a weekend.
Okay. And I guess plenty enough time. And it is sad seeing, we've seen across our social media, you know, friends of yours, friends of ours,
yeah.
just posting some pictures about seeing some of their loved ones off and, you know, 10 people. What a decision that must be within the family to say, listen, I know you were a cousin, or I know that you know, et cetera, et cetera, but only these 10 can attend the funeral. That's difficult, isn't it?
It's incredibly. And we've been, I think I shared with you, we've been talking to faith leaders about this.
Yeah.
Just asking them to help us prepare people for that reality that they may not be able to be at the bed of their loved one,
yeah.
a bedside, as they pass away, and that the circumstances around the funeral will be very restrictive. And in fact, it's a conversation we'll be having with them in the next few days. We've been talking about a collective city event. I don't want to call it service because it's not that, civic occasion,
yeah.
in which, with all the faith groups and leaders of non-faith groups, we come together as a city just to recognise all the loss that would have happened during this time. And when I talk about loss, we are talking about people losing family.
Yeah.
But these people that have lost jobs and businesses and relationships as well, you know, there'll be so much loss going through in this period of time. And we just want collectively as a city to make sure people know that we recognize that it matters to us as a city. So, we, you know, some of these things can't be legislated for. It's yeah. just stuff that you do with your culture and your values. And so we're looking at that area now and doing some planning.
So that's Bristol's Labour Mayor Marvin Rees talking about a kind of civic loss event, Mary. What do you make of that? The idea that all of the things that we really desperately wanted to do but we couldn't do during the pandemic, that we can come together in some way afterwards to, in a way, to share that grief.
The coronavirus COVID-19 situation is definitely a lesson in grief and loss that I'm pretty certain that none of us wished that we had to go through. There is an absolute need, I think, to enable people to come to terms with that grief and loss, whether it be for a loved one who has died, whether it be for the end of a relationship, because actually under lockdown conditions, that's meant that you've seen different aspects or sides to your partner that you feel that there is no future for you. Or if it's the simplest of loss of the fact that, you know, a 3 or 4 year old hasn't had that exit from their nursery and playgroup whereby they were able to say goodbye to their friends before they start school, or you know, at the other end of the scale, celebrations of significant birthdays for our elderly population, where you might have wanted to have a triumphal event for an 80th, 90th, or even 100th birthday, and you know, and haven't we all been touched by Captain Tom Moore and the situation there. I think 140,000 birthday cards sent to him from around the globe and over £30 million raised for charity. You know, so in that public outpouring of grief, the UK has got a reputation for being a little bit more reticent, stiff upper lip. But in 1997, when Princess Diana died, something was unleashed with our nation's psyche, and we have been able to express that a little bit more. So having some form of memorial service in the way that we do, and when we mark the deaths of the First World War heroes, and then subsequently anybody else who has died within conflict, as we do in November. And we are approaching the commemoration of VE Day next week. So, you know, it is only fit and right and proper that we would be allowed for the people who need it to mark their grief and their loss in public. Other people will want to do it in private, and that is totally up to them. But Marvin is quite right to say that the cemeteries, crematoriums, all of those spaces that are for that, they should be left free for people in order to have either that quiet private stillness or to have a commemoration and indeed a celebration of the life that the person that they have lost has led. And it should not be for exercise or general use.
Tom, your thoughts then on this idea of all of the things that we really wanted to do, but we couldn't do during the pandemic, having some kind of a civic gathering, he called it, not a service. That's what the mayor's suggesting.
I think, you know, some kind of event to mark the difficulties that we've all been through, I think, you know, it's not a bad idea. I think, you know, depending on the timing of that, it shouldn't be a physical event. I think, you know, the end of the lockdown or the easing of the lockdown won't mean an immediate return to large gatherings on that kind of scale. But, you know, as we know from this, there are from the way that we're managing this interview, for example, there are other means of being able to do that. I think, you know, personally, I'm an atheist. The faith aspect of it wouldn't comfort me, but I do realise that that is of great comfort and support to some people, in particularly in times like this. I do think, however, that you know, while no kind of political response to this could have avoided loss entirely, unfortunately, some of it has been avoidable and has happened anyway. And the most important priority for now is constricting any more unnecessary loss. So, you know, things like protective equipment, like testing, like giving the people the wherewithal to be able to self-isolate to the extent that is necessary, those are the number one priorities at this point. And, you know, some people would say, well, it's crass to make political points off the back of a crisis. I think that's totally wrong. I think it's more important than ever now to hold the government account to their failings, because the stakes are far, far higher than they are during normal times. And I'm afraid failings is exactly the right word for their response to this.
If I can just add to what Tom's just said there, very quickly, on Twitter, there's been some discussion about, you know, the government's policies, and it's something that I've been saying quite often. Every policy that politicians put forward inevitably ends up with a choice being made. The majority of policies put forward at some point could lead to some people dying. There is the fact is that it is a choice. Politics is a choice, and that's why it's important that you choose the party that you believe has the right political policy in order to support the minimum amount of people dying in these circumstances, or the policies that, that you really think that it is worth those deaths for.
Okay, our final clip is from Benoit Bennett at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, and they have been dealing with homeless people in the city, carrying on in their essential work of giving basic advice to the homeless and now also feeding homeless people too. It's worth noting, of course, that we had hundreds of homeless people, many rough sleepers in the city, and the councillors always told us that they were doing all they could, and all of a sudden now the pandemic is here, they have been put up in hotels, something like 300 or 400 people now living in hotels. So let's hear from Benoit Bennett from PRSC.
We, as well as doing this ongoing project that we've been doing for a while, we've started up a new food project ourselves, because we've been seeing the people who are left on the streets don't have any of their income, which is often begging or people who sell their dope magazine that we provide them. There's no one out there giving them their money now, and a lot of those people are hungry. And when people first been put up, I know that there was no food being provided apart from instant noodles, because that is all the hotel rooms have in terms of cooking facilities is a kettle. So we've been handing out food two times a week, and we're hoping to keep stepping that up. That is a serious issue. There are definitely lots of hungry people out there, and most of the projects that had up until now been providing food to people in need have had to shut down because all their volunteers have stopped, or their suppliers have stopped, or their kitchens are closed. I think we've always, us and several other people have always argued for a housing first type of option, and this kind of shows when there is actually willing, when it's considered a priority, then it can happen. And it's amazing, but also disheartening that it was never enough of a priority, that these people's lives were so difficult beforehand.
And what's going to happen if the lockdown finishes? I mean, suddenly people are going to be back on the streets again, are they?
As far as I'm aware, that's the plan. I think on an assigned day, trying to evict several hundred formerly homeless people from a hotel might provide some challenges, especially when it's done in conjunction with things like other people who've had their rent put off suddenly finding themselves up for eviction or in huge debt, or I don't know, there are loads of things that are just being put off during this emergency that when it all comes through at the end will either mean massive change socially or some kind of really, really authoritarian response to enforce that everything went back to so-called normal.
So when is your advice sessions and where?
So every Tuesday between 2 and 4, we run our street survival sessions at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. And at the end of that, at 4 o'clock, we hand out food directly there and also take extras down to Bosch, who hand out food in Broadmead. And then on Sundays, we're also doing another food run to fill in a gap because there's no afternoon or evening meals being served. So on a Sunday afternoon at 2, we're also doing a soup distribution down in Broadmead as well.
Okay, so that's Benoit Bennett there from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, doing essential work with the homeless. I've also noticed this week, Mary, that we've seen construction sites, some here in St Paul's, reopening again. Some of those construction workers wandering around with no hard hats, no social distancing going on the sites, if you can see this as you just walk past them. And one does wonder if maybe the homeless again are being rather forgotten, and the most highly financialised parts of our sector, the powerful construction industry, which is a powerful lobby with government, is just saying, well, the lockdown is not for us.
I think, to be fair to Bristol City Council, the way that they have gone to the private sector and looked for roofs above the heads of the homeless people within Bristol and have found anywhere between 250 to 300 beds for people. In fact, I think they found more beds, but they've had less take up from individuals. you know, has to be applauded and commended. But I think you're right that, or I think the speaker was right from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, that what happens when lockdown finishes and those people are told that they can't have that room anymore. So we have to have a very long, hard look at the way we provide shelter for the absolutely most vulnerable people in society, many of whom, not all, but many of whom have severe mental health conditions, and the support we provide for them. And we have to say, all of this outpouring of good nature and goodwill, where people have charity fundraised across the country because they have suddenly had an experience that made them connected to other humans around the globe. We have to take that forward, and we have to leave some of the past practices that weren't working for the most vulnerable behind. And I think that we also have to look about those benefit systems that have trapped people without homes. Those systems, they're called benefits. They're not, they're a life support system. We shouldn't be talking about a benefit to just keep someone alive. It's an essential service to keep someone alive. And our society should not be going back to the 1800s, where we had the poorhouse and the destitute back then, which I think is where some of the Conservative government MPs would like to take us. We need to have a much more compassionate society that says every life matters. We value the skills and talents of every human being, because any of them could become the next Florence Nightingale, the next Albert Einstein, the next Greta Thunberg. They could be anything they choose to be, provided we provide them an equal platform of opportunity to take themselves forward. And, you know, so the practical reality is, the practical reality is, I think it's important to say this, the practical reality is, a lot of people have started talking about a universal basic income, and that might be a way where it could be trialled to support people who are homeless to stay in the accommodation that they've been given. It's going to be a challenge because the tourist industry, the hotel industry that have stepped in to support and provide those beds are obviously going to want to go back to their usual business income. But we have to find some way. And I've personally been talking about more of a minimum income guarantee, and there's pros and cons of doing a universal basic income or a minimum income guarantee, but whether you give it to all and therefore have no costs of assessment, or whether you give it to people when their income drops below. It is ridiculous going through a benefit system that says, oh, well, you don't need any money for 5 weeks. Most people haven't got as much as a month's wages put aside in the economy we've got, because our economy has become so unfair, and the disparity between those who have and those who have not. And I was going to come on to your point about construction with that, because that fits into it. A lot of workers, as we've discovered, have become so unstable with fixed-term contracts, short-term contracts, zero-hour contracts. Again, we have got this echo back to the 1800s, where people have no job security. I'm a trade unionist, and I fundamentally believe that, you know, the way people work and the way they are paid for their work needs to be fair. We shouldn't be having situations whereby the mayor and the cabinet in Bristol are taking a £9,000 pay rise for the mayor and significant pay rises for the cabinet, when other people are taking cuts and need their wages.
Mary, that's a 12.5%. That's a 12.5% pay rise, which is an enormous pay rise for anybody.
And I know. Normally, I would defend it. Normally, I would say, as a trade unionist, people need to be paid fairly for the jobs they do. But in the current circumstances, in where other people are taking a 20% pay cut because they're furloughed or losing their jobs altogether, it just doesn't sit right that other people are accepting a pay rise, even though they didn't actually set that for themselves. It was set by an independent panel. It's just not a comfortable fit for me. And £9,000 is more than some people get on benefit per year.
A lot more, especially when they've had their benefits cut. Tom,
I mean, I'll wait. I'll find out what I get next week. I've had no money for 5 weeks, and luckily I'd had enough put aside so I could run for office. But I'd worked out my finances so I could run for office until the 7th of May next week. And then I would look to try and find a job again. Well, I'm now trying to find a job again and looking at consultancy work. And lucky I'm probably quite fortunate in the area that I work in. I can probably find some work. But, most people are not in that position. And, we really need to look at our whole system.
And because of the
change the system.
Because of the mass redundancies, of course, there is an enormous dearth in the job market as well. It's loads of people suddenly looking for jobs. Tom, what do you make of this difference? I suppose the contrast between the reopening up of much of the construction industry in Britain, very difficult to see any social distancing going on the construction sites near me in St. Paul's, but the contrast, I suppose, with the treatment of the homeless.
Yeah, I think, firstly, I'll just touch on Mary's last point. I'm also a trade unionist in general. I'm definitely in favour of pay rises, but I don't think political positions like the mayor are ordinary jobs. You're supposed to be a representative, and I don't think you can represent people unless the decisions you make affect you in the same way that they affect everybody else. And that is why I pledge when the election starts again that I will stand on the basis of only taking a worker's wage should I be elected mayor, which is the principle that all Socialist Party representatives put forward. But I think on your other question, then what Benoit from the People's Republic of Stokescroft said is just one example among many of why we cannot, after this crisis, return to what was the so-called normal before it, because that was not working for millions of people, not just for the most oppressed and marginalised, like the homeless people that Benoit works with. And the fact that in response to this crisis, we have been able to house homeless people really proves that dealing with many of these issues wasn't a case of what could or couldn't be done, but it was a choice. This was a case of what the priorities of those politicians were. Politicians from many different parties in governments and councils across a long time in reality. And that reflects not just the individual choices of politicians, but also the logic of a capitalist system that is based upon the exploitation of a majority in favour of the profits of a minority. That, by the way, is the reason why the construction sites are reopening, because making profit for the big construction firms is more important to them than protecting their staff is. And I agree, there's no way on a construction site that you're able to self-isolate effectively. And because of the very insecure working or the so-called self-employment that a lot of construction workers are forced to work under, then it can't be the individual choice of those workers to refuse to go back to work because it would mean that no income, it would mean starvation. And so, the examples that we've seen of workers walking out of unsafe workplaces, acting collaboratively, I think is very, very important. But that idea that we're based, our society, a capitalist society, is based on profit, is why I'm a socialist, why I think that there needs to be a revolutionary, a wholesale change in the basis of society. I want to see a society where the wealth that's created by workers is owned and is democratically controlled by workers. I think that's the only basis on which you can see the real equality that Mary kind of said was an aspiration.
I have to agree with Tom, with Tom to a certain extent on
yeah.
that.
I mean, I'd just like both of you, that. Just a second, yeah. Mary, I want like just both of you finally to just sum up what you think life after lockdown could look like and should look like. Mary, you first.
I absolutely have hope that life after lockdown can be different. And I have hope that women will play a much greater role in making that happen. What we've seen with the COVID-19 support groups is that there are a huge number of women who are doing community politics at that grassroots level. And I pray and hope, not that I have a religion, I pray and hope that will continue, that the experiences that people have gone through, the hundreds of thousands of people who have lost their jobs and have had to deal with a very unfair and precarious benefits system that treats you like a number, not as a human being, that doesn't value your talents, that just wants you to get off their numbers and into any job, regardless of whether or not that is good for you or your family. I have hope that we will look forward to a better society, one that recognises the benefit that we've been given by having a much, much cleaner air in Bristol, and therefore can understand what's at stake when perhaps we might need to bring in something that is going to impact and affect lots of people by having a clean air zone and preventing travel, but that we can look towards that the benefit is worth it, not having 300 lives on average lost per year through air pollution. Is something that is worth having a few personal inconveniences over. I don't want those deaths on my conscience, and I'm pretty sure that the rest of Bristol doesn't either.
Righto, Tom. Final word to you. What do you think from the Trade Union Socialist Alliance would be the life after lockdown? How would you like to see it?
What I'd like to see is no return to normal. I think what's been proved through this crisis is that it's workers that create the wealth. We're the ones that run that make society run, and we should run society. I think that kind of control and ownership over the wealth that we create won't be given to us. We have to be organised. We have to fight for that kind of change. But what we've seen in terms of workers acting collaboratively to push through changes in the workplace to increase their safety, communities coming together in order to provide the kind of support and service that is needed to one another. Those kind of things have only strengthened my belief that this is possible and that this kind of socialist change is necessary.
So that's it. That was Whatever Happened to Bristol's Democracy, a programme, a Hub Hustings, which replaces the postponed elections. And we'll be looking again next week at the whole subject of what will be happening with discussing the possibility of democracy in the city on the week of the elections too. So we heard there from Liberal Democrat Mary Page, the Trade Union and Socialist Alliance, Tom Baldwin. Also, in the earlier part of the programme, who had to go, Conservative Party's Samuel Williams and the Green Party's Sandy Hoare-Ruthven. The mayor, the Labour mayor, Marvin Rees, who was also the Labour candidate, sent me a letter saying, I'm sorry, but the mayor is unavailable at this time. He's regularly speaking about COVID-19 on BCFM, and so additional interview requests will not be prioritised. That was from Simon Cowley, the mayor's office policy manager. So that is it for now. That's it for part one. We'll be back in a minute with our weekly look around the world. Thank you very much for the patience of our guests, and some apologies for the sound quality. Obviously, we're not in the radio studio. We're here at home recording this. So thanks very much to Mary and Tom, particularly, for sticking it till the end. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tony.
If anybody out there is struggling, go ask for help.
Good point. Yeah, okay, Dave.
The can-do service of the Bristol City Council has been inundated by volunteers. Go ask for help.
Righto, thanks everybody.